Welcome to the podcast series of Middle East and Africa Textile Journal. What if I told you that moving your manufacturing, physically closer to your target market could actually make your production slower?
Right. And way more expensive.
Exactly. And infinitely more complicated. Because, I mean, if you are leading a sourcing team or managing a supply chain right now, the temptation to just sign a contract in a neighboring country and call your logistics problems fixed, well, it's massive.
Oh, it's huge. Everyone is talking about nearshoring like it's this ultimate cure for all the chaos we've seen over the last few years.
Yeah. But today, our mission in this deep dive is to basically dismantle that buzzword. We're exploring the strategic evolution of global textile nearshoring using this brilliant article from March 31st, 2026, titled Beyond Proximity.
Which is a great piece.
It really is. The perspective here perfectly aligns with the Cohan Textile Journal, and we're going to use it to uncover what actually drives long-term competitiveness. Because treating nearshoring as a magic bullet is, well, it's a lot like moving a commercial bakery right next door to your best customers just to serve them faster.
Right, but you're still relying on flour and sugar that has to be shipped on a slow boat from across the ocean.
Exactly. You haven't actually sped up the baking process. You've just changed where you are waiting for the delivery.
Well, what's fascinating here is how that bakery analogy exposes the core misunderstanding in the industry right now. Because nearshoring is currently functioning as a window of opportunity, right? It's not a standalone long-term strategy.
It's a phase.
Yeah, it's a temporary opening. It's been created by, intense geopolitical pressures, severe logistics disruptions, and these increasingly strict sustainability demands. So brands are just reacting to immediate pain points.
Like they just want to avoid the nightmare of a container ship getting stuck in a canal somewhere.
Exactly. Or like a sudden tariff hike. But merely changing your geographic zip code doesn't magically upgrade your industrial capabilities.
Okay, let's unpack this. Because if we look at what European brands are actually doing within this so-called window of opportunity, it's largely defensive.
Highly defensive.
Right. They are desperately trying to diversify their sourcing to gain some flexibility and cut down on delivery times. But when you dig into the data, this shift is almost entirely tactical. It's not structural.
And a tactical maneuver is just a bandage.
Yeah. They're using nearshoring for very specific high turnover segments, like we're talking about quick replenishment orders. Imagine a retailer suddenly realizes a specific jacket is going viral on social media, right?
Right, and they need thousands more on the shelves in a matter of weeks.
Exactly. That or smaller specialized production runs for fast fashion cycles.
But the structural reality,
yeah.
I mean, the bigger picture is a completely different beast. The massive core volumes, like the millions of basic t-shirts, the standard denim orders.
Big stuff that actually pays the bills.
Exactly. The financial backbone of these global brands, those are still firmly rooted in traditional manufacturing mega hubs in Asia.
Still.
Oh, absolutely. Those traditional hubs maintain their grip on core production because, frankly, their cost efficiency and sheer scale are just fundamentally unmatched.
Right.
You simply cannot replicate decades of deeply entrenched industrial scaling overnight. Just because you happen to be a shorter boat ride away from a European port.
So if the core volume is staying put in Asia, then calling this a supply chain revolution feels incredibly premature.
It's a massive overstatement.
It's basically emergency backup planning, masquerading as a long-term strategy. And the fundamental reason these emerging nearshore destinations can't handle those massive core volumes comes down to a fatal structural flaw, right? No. A severe lack of upstream integration. Like if a hub doesn't have the local spinning mills to process raw fiber.
Or the massive dyeing facilities required to process fabric at scale.
Right. If they don't have that, they are essentially paralyzed. They can cut and sew the garment, but they can't create the canvas.
And that paralysis is the invisible anchor dragging down the nearshoring dream. Because these regions lack local spinning, weaving, and wet processing capabilities, their supply chain remains highly fragmented.
They have to import everything.
Exactly. They are forced to rely heavily on imported raw materials. So rather than a streamlined process, you have this fragmented network where, like, a delay at a customs checkpoint for a single shipment of dye stuff can shut down an entire factory floor for days.
Yikes.
And when you add in the macroeconomic factors that the source highlights, rising regional energy costs, climbing labor expenses, and intense new compliance requirements, whatever competitive edge geographical proximity initially offered begins to rapidly erode.
Well, let me push back on the timeline of that erosion with a specific scenario.
Sure.
If I'm a European apparel brand, right, and I've contracted a factory just across the Mediterranean in North Africa. I've theoretically cut my shipping time for the final product from weeks down to days.
Right, the final leg.
Yeah. So even if that North African factory has to import the yarn from Asia, doesn't the fact that the final assembly is happening right on Europe's doorstep still save me a massive amount of time in getting the finished garment to market?
Well, this raises an important question, and it's actually the exact trap that sourcing directors fall into when they only look at the final leg of the journey.
How so?
Think about the physics of a fragmented supply chain. If your nearshore factory has to wait 4 to 6 weeks for that raw fabric to arrive from Asia before they can even power on the sewing machines, that waiting period completely negates the speed and flexibility that nearshoring promised in the first place.
Ah,
You are
ish.
still tethered to global logistics bottlenecks. The delay just happens upstream, out of sight of the brand, until the factory calls to say they can't hit the deadline.
So the geographic shortcut is basically a mirage if the raw materials are taking the long way around.
Exactly. Now, contrast that fragmented reality with established players in traditional hubs. They operate within fully integrated ecosystems.
Meaning everything is close by.
Right. The cotton is spun into yarn, woven into fabric, dyed, cut, and sewn, all within a tightly controlled, highly concentrated geographic radius. There is no waiting for a ship to cross an ocean between steps two and three.
Wow.
Because of that structural density, they can offer blazing speed and massive scale simultaneously. It makes it incredibly difficult for a nearshoring hub, which is, constantly refreshing a tracking number, for imported yarn to compete on a structural level.
I mean, competing on sheer volume or rock bottom costs against those fully integrated mega hubs is a losing battle. The math simply doesn't work.
It really doesn't.
So for nearshore regions to survive, they have to completely change the rules of engagement. Because for decades, the dominant business model in these emerging textile regions has been simple subcontracting.
Right, the cut and make model.
Yeah, a European brand sends over a highly detailed tech pack, and the factory just blindly executes it. Subcontracting provided a stable baseline, and got these regions integrated into the global market, but it's a model that has hit a concrete ceiling.
It's a race to the bottom based entirely on who can operate the sewing machine the cheapest. The source material is adamant that manufacturers must evolve beyond mere execution.
They have to do more.
Exactly. The required shift is toward value-added services. Factories need to build and integrate their own in-house design capabilities, offer sophisticated product development, and provide raw material sourcing expertise directly to the brands.
Yeah, and here's where it gets really interesting. Think about this evolution like the culinary world.
Oh, I like
The
this.
subcontracting model is like being a short order cook. You are handed a ticket with a strict recipe, you make exactly what is written on the ticket, and you are entirely replaceable by anyone else who can read that same recipe.
You're just an executor.
Right. But the new model requires becoming a consulting chef. You sit down with the restaurant owners, you tell them which local ingredients are freshest this season, you design the menu from scratch, and you engineer the dishes to maximize their profit margins.
That's a great way to put it. When you operate as the consulting chef, you transition from being a disposable vendor to an indispensable strategic partner.
Exactly.
By participating much earlier in the value chain, manufacturers capture significantly higher profit margins. They aren't just charging for minutes of labor anymore. They're charging for intellectual property and problem solving.
Right, they're bringing ideas to the table.
Yeah. Like if a factory can go to a European buyer and say, "Hey, we engineered this pattern to reduce fabric waste by 12%, and we pre-sourced a certified organic blend that cuts your lead time by a month," they have fundamentally changed the power dynamic.
That's massive.
It is. The ultimate goal outlined in the research is shifting from a dynamic of pure execution to a dynamic of co-creation.
And co-creation completely redefines the manufacturer-brand relationship. But, in today's climate, sitting at the table as a co-creator isn't just about picking out nicer buttons or predicting next season's color trends.
Not at all.
It is heavily tied to the most complex, expensive, and heavily regulated issue in the industry right now, which is sustainability.
Oh, absolutely.
The article is brutally clear that environmental regulations in Europe are no longer optional bonuses. We are talking about strict traceability of every fiber, mandatory recycling requirements woven into the product design, and total carbon footprint transparency.
These are no longer marketing initiatives. They are absolute unbending entry conditions to even do business in the European market.
You literally can't get in without them.
Right. And the transition is sending a massive shockwave through the supply chain. because the industry's readiness for these mandates is dangerously uneven. Upgrading a traditional subcontracting factory to meet European environmental standards requires immense financial capital and deep technical expertise.
Because the mechanics of actually doing this are staggeringly complex. I mean, a traditional short-order cook factory usually buys off-the-shelf yarn from anonymous regional brokers just to keep their costs as low as possible. To suddenly provide end-to-end traceability, they have to completely upend their procurement network. They have to hire compliance officers, install specialized supply chain tracking software, conduct expensive third-party audits,
and figure out how to measure their scope 3 carbon emissions.
Right, when they might not even know how the local energy grid is powered on any given Tuesday.
Exactly.
Yeah.
The sheer friction of implementing those mechanics is exactly why The Source predicts a severe fragmentation of the sector. The barrier to entry has spiked so high that the market will aggressively divide into winners who have the capital and agility to adapt, and losers who will simply be locked out of the European market.
It's basically an existential filter.
It is.
Which is a crucial reality check for anyone listening who still views sustainability as like a feel-good corporate initiative. If you don't have the capital to invest in that traceability and transparency infrastructure right now, your proximity to Europe means absolutely nothing. You are effectively locked out.
But, you know, if we connect this to the bigger picture, this massive regulatory hurdle is actually the ultimate strategic opportunity for these nearshoring hubs.
How so?
Well, let's return to the concept of differentiation. A nearshore factory cannot beat an Asian mega hub on volume, and they definitely can't beat them on the raw cost of labor. But if a region can successfully align its geographic proximity with proven, highly regulated, sustainable production capability,
oh, they become invaluable.
Exactly. They instantly become the holy grail for European brands.
Because the brands are desperate for compliance. Without it, their goods will literally be stopped at the border.
Right.
So if a manufacturer just across the Mediterranean can guarantee that compliance alongside faster shipping, they don't just win the contract, they get to dictate the terms. You stop fighting the unwinnable cost war, and you start dominating the compliance and agility war.
Exactly. How these hubs position themselves is critical. They must carve out a highly specialized niche. The data suggests their survival depends on winning across three specific metrics: speed, flexibility, and reliability.
Got it.
However, this is specifically tailored for short production cycles and mid-sized collections. You essentially become the absolute best in the world at turning around a highly sustainable, flawlessly compliant mid-sized collection in record time.
But there is a massive caveat to that strategy, right? You cannot achieve that level of speed and reliability if the environment outside the factory walls is failing you.
That is the big catch.
And we see this ecosystem failure playing out right now in the push into Africa. The African market is constantly touted in business media as the next great frontier for textile production, like the ultimate nearshoring destination capable of serving Europe. Yet the reality on the ground is incredibly harsh.
It really is.
Yeah.
The African market is a perfect case study in why geographic proximity is meaningless without a functional ecosystem.
Right.
While the continent offers proximity and immense demographic potential, the actual expansion of large-scale textile manufacturing is severely restricted. The article points to deeply underdeveloped logistics networks, limited local purchasing power, and a massive influx of cheap secondhand imports.
Which kills the local markets.
Exactly. It prevents local manufacturers from building the domestic baseline they need to support massive export operations.
I mean, if the roads leading from the factory to the port are potholed, or if the local power grid goes down twice a week, your nearshore speed advantage just evaporates instantly.
It's gone.
You can have the most technologically advanced, sustainable sewing machines on the planet, but if you can't reliably turn the lights on or get a truck to the dock, you fail.
Which is why the successful opportunities in the African market right now are highly targeted. The growth isn't in broad fast fashion exports. It's in specific segments like uniforms, workwear, and institutional supply.
That makes a lot of sense.
Yeah. Success in those areas relies on building long-term partnerships and fostering deep regional integration, rather than just opening a factory and expecting a sudden boom in European orders. It proves that a factory cannot outcompete the structural disadvantages of the region it sits in.
So what does this all mean? It means that competitiveness is no longer decided just on the factory floor. The broader ecosystem is the true foundation of your strategy.
Absolutely.
You need a host country that provides stable energy costs, accessible financing so factories can actually afford those expensive sustainability upgrades, and clear, supportive regulatory frameworks. If the ecosystem is broken, the proximity is useless.
The macro environment dictates the micro success. If the logistics network is slow, or if local tariffs on imported yarn wipe out your margins, no amount of internal factory efficiency will save the business model.
So to wrap this up for the textile industry professionals navigating all this chaos, we need to crystallize the core takeaway from this deep dive. Nearshoring is an open door, not a destination.
Right.
It is certainly not a standalone solution to supply chain vulnerability. To survive this global realignment, the industry must transition away from tactical short-term bandage fixes.
Survival requires a fundamental structural evolution. Sourcing strategies must shift toward long-term commitments. That means actively investing in upstream integration so you aren't paralyzed waiting for imported raw materials.
Essential.
It means fully abandoning the pure subcontracting model in favor of value-added co-creation. And it demands massive capital-intensive commitments to verifiable sustainability.
The conclusion of our source material captures it perfectly. The future of competitiveness in the global textile industry is defined by capability, not geography. The winners of the next decade won't be the brands or manufacturers who simply happen to share a border.
No, not at all.
The winners will be those who are, to use the exact words of the research, smarter, faster, and more adaptable.
This leaves us with a critical thought to consider regarding your own operations. If proximity is merely a geographic advantage, one that can be instantly wiped out by a single shipping delay for raw materials or a sudden spike in a local energy grid, what is the true uncopyable advantage in your supply chain today?
That's the real question.
Are you relying on the false security of where you are located on a map, or are you actively building depth, shared innovation, and absolute trust into the collaborative relationship between your brand and your manufacturing partners?
If you're relying on a map to save your business, you might be looking at the wrong tool entirely. Thank you for joining us for this deep dive. We hope this conversation helps you look at your own supply chain a little differently and encourages you to keep questioning the obvious solutions in your field. Until next time, keep digging deeper.